This is
Make It Kind.
M.I.P.
with Masamela Matfumo.
Mark Thompson.
Make It Kind.
Get woke.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined from the White House by the Deputy Director of the Gender Policy Council, Katie Keith. Katie Keith, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. What is the White House up to lately? We've been seeing a lot of the conversation, especially coming from the Vice President, not that we've not heard from the President, the pledge to restore Roe. But what else is going on? I know it's campaign season, too, and that is probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest issue coming up on the ballot, Roe-vember.
Yeah, totally agree with you there. I can't speak too much to the campaign side. What I would say is, of course, President Biden, even today, is at a campaign stop in Florida talking about our fight for reproductive freedom. He's doing that ahead of Florida already has an abortion ban, but he's there ahead of what is slated to be an even more extreme and dangerous abortion ban going into effect in Florida next week. And we are continuing to talk about how important reproductive freedom is, the stakes here, and also what we're doing. So you're exactly right. Reproductive freedom has been a huge priority for the administration really since day one of January of 2021. And all that work became just really even more important since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. The president, on the day of that decision, he's been crystal clear, the vice president's been crystal clear that it's what you said. We do need Congress to pass a federal law restoring the protections of Roe versus Wade. That is the only way we are going to restore the right to choose for women in every state all across the country. And in the meantime, the administration, directed by the president in the three executive orders he's put forward, we're doing everything we can to use our current authority to try to protect women in as many possible ways as we can. So what that has looked like so far is defending access to emergency medical care. We've given guidance to hospitals and doctors to make sure that women have emergency care that they're entitled to under federal law. That's something we're defending for the Supreme Court. We've tried to strengthen access to affordable contraception, which is, will not surprise anyone, is even more important after the Dobbs decision than it was before. So we're focused on contraception. And then even yesterday, the Department of Health and Human Services put forward a new rule to strengthen privacy protection. So for patients and providers, for those who are seeking or getting or providing lawful reproductive health care, it's our position that no one should have their medical records used against them or their doctor or their loved one when they've needed reproductive health care. And so those are just some examples of what we've been doing. I think you will also continue to see the president, the vice president, really all of us also just talk about the stories and what's at stake. Women's health and lives are really at stake all across the country. And so we continue to point and amplify the really devastating consequences of overturning Roe versus Wade, where women are being denied care that they need, forced to travel hundreds of miles to get care that they otherwise would have received in their state if Roe was still the law of the land. So there's a lot going on. I'm happy to unpack any of that, but that's a little bit of what we've been doing.
Well, let's start with emergency medical care. It tells me more about that that crisis and where that stands? And did you say that's at the court level as well?
Absolutely. So I can't, because of that, I can't say too much more about it, but the Supreme Court will hear oral argument over our efforts to defend access to emergency medical care under federal law. And so this, what we're seeing all across the country is that women have been turned away from emergency medical rooms. Maybe they're having a miscarriage or they've had some other complication. And if Roe was still the law land, there would be a question of whether they could get the care that they need. But because of these state abortion bans, because of this extreme agenda from Republican elected officials, there's questions about doctors feeling like their hands are tied and they're going to go to jail if they provide the care that they were trained to provide. And we have tried to make really clear that under federal law, women are entitled to emergency, truly emergency care to save their health or their life. And that's what we're up defending before the Supreme Court.
So to be clear, even though the Supreme Court made the Dobbs decision, our argument is that their women are still protected and can be, it is legal to provide them emergency care, even if that emergency care means an abortion. Is that the case?
That's it. And the federal law I'm referring to is called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. And what it really stands for our position is that women who are experiencing pregnancy-related emergencies or complications are entitled to emergency medical treatment, including an abortion, if that's what their doctor recommends, when they qualify under that law. This is it's all about emergency medical care and making sure women can access that in truly devastating circumstances when their health or life is at risk.
And so obviously that's not happening because some people, one, probably aren't fully aware of it, or they're scared, right? That people are running from it because they don't want to be retaliated against.
I think that's it. And again, this would not even, we wouldn't even have to be having this conversation if you still had this fundamental constitutional right that women had in this country for nearly 50 years, and you didn't have doctors in the emergency room trying to care for their patient on the one hand, but also worried about the law on the other hand, even as they're trying to navigate what can just, again, be really devastating circumstances. So that's one example of the type of work that we've been doing.
One more thing to have you unpack, though, on the privacy piece. I'm inferring that even though there are HIPAA laws, people are still violating women's individual privacies when it comes to their reproductive health. Is that what's going on? Is this a political thing that's happening? People are doing this politically or what?
I think there have been concerns that patients' medical records will be used against them or their doctor or their loved one. And so this is something we've heard from really providers all across the country, that maybe they're holding back in their conversations with patients. They're not giving as much information as they might want to do. They're not making the referral to an out-of-state provider. And so this is about really making sure that our doctors all across the country and patients have access to the accurate, comprehensive information that they need in your medical records. It's just, we don't think those medical records should be able to be sort of used against you or your doctor when you got lawful reproductive health care. So this is, again, about, I think, safeguarding and really strengthening patient privacy.
Lastly, you mentioned stories, and the stories really make the point. Madam Deputy Director, what's the most recent and most compelling story you've heard?
I will not be able to, that's a very unfair question. I can't pick just one compelling story by any stretch, but what it is bringing to mind is for the State of the Union address the President gave, I believe in March, the First Lady had two patients with her joining for the speech. One was a woman, Kate Cox. She's a mother of two from Texas. Her doctor recommended that she have an abortion given some complications. There are three abortion bans in effect currently in Texas. She actually went to court to sue to get clarity that she could get the abortion that she needed. And she even was ultimately forced to travel to get the health care she wanted because of these extreme abortion bans. The First Lady was also joined by woman Victoria Beasley, who lives in, I think, Birmingham, Alabama, and was affected by the disruption to IVF and fertility services in Alabama after their Supreme Court there raised all kinds of questions. Again, this chaos and confusion that we've seen unleashed since the Supreme Court's decision. And so she had her procedures interrupted. And again, even families who are desperately trying to build their families are caught in just the chaos and confusion we've seen since the Supreme Court overturned Roe.
Yeah.
So those are two examples that come immediately to mind that are the types of stories we're going to continue to tell. This is just so deeply personal. These are such personal, important decisions that we think families and women and doctors should get to make, not politicians and not elected officials.
And I'm going to say this is not the deputy director saying this because I don't want to get her in trouble politically, but I think I can say this, that what the Gender Policy Council, what the deputy director is doing, what the White House is doing is the difference between having role restored, ultimately is what we want, versus other folks coming on the scene and there being a further ban on women's reproductive rights. And I know we don't have a lot of time, folks, as I've talked about, this is not just about abortion either. Women's reproductive health, women's bodily autonomy is what is on the line. Correct?
I think that's abortion. Exactly right. Absolutely goes beyond abortion. We're seeing attacks on contraception. We've seen the attacks on IVF. All these state restrictions are making worse the maternal health care crisis all in states all across the country. The vice president has been, I think, really at the forefront of making that argument that the states with the most extreme abortion bans are the states that do the worst on the maternal health care crisis. And so there, I think you're exactly right. This is all about access to health care and helping women make the decisions that they want to make, but really fundamentally get the care that they need.
And we all saw what happened with IVF. A lot of folk who weren't with us, then when IVF came in, they said, wait a minute, hold up now. Just slow down, slow your roll. So folks, we'll continue to watch this. Deputy Director of the White House Gender Policy Council doing very, very important, very urgent work. As men, women's health is critical as well. If women's health is jeopardized, our health is jeopardized as men. All right, I want people to keep that in mind. Thank you, Madam Deputy Director. Thank you for updating us. And as news develops, as initiatives develop, and as new things begin to happen that the community and the public can support and help push, please let us know, okay?
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Time again for another edition of our favorite segment, Thursday Coast, with the founder of the largest online progressive community, DailyCoast.com, the founder of Civics with a Q, and the host of the ever-popular podcast, Well Brief, Marcos Melissus, joins us from the left coast. Hey, man, how are you?
Doing great. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm okay. These SCOTUS arguments, I try to follow them. You really have to, because there's no camera. You have to be absolutely attentive and listening, and you really have to take a day off from everything else to really focus in and try to listen to everything that's being said. There's no transcript until later. But then I battle with myself because I'm like, what is the point? Because what comes up in the arguments and in the questioning rarely reflects what we're going to see. And then in this particular case, man, I don't think they have any, they're doing it so late.
Which case, off, Mark?
In the Trump case, in the case we're talking about today, of course, in the Trump immunity case, they're doing it so late in the game, you really have to wonder, they're going to just drag this out. And if they can drag it out, they can drag it out till the end of the year if they want to. So I don't have a lot of hope in this.
Yeah, that seems to be the path they're taking with the hope that then Trump wins the election and then Trump can squash it. And then he never has to deal with the consequences of his illegal behavior. that's clearly seems to be where the Republican justices, even the swing ones like Roberts, appear to be sympathetic from what the legal observers are saying and tracking like the live blogs and stuff. Now, we have to understand that a lot of times these justices, they play devil's advocate in the oral arguments and then they rule a different way, or they may get in the room and they may all hash out some kind of compromise agreement or so. There's a lot that can happen from here to there. But if this court validates this absurd theory that a president is above the law, and to be clear, Trump's lawyer said today two crazy things. One, he said that, and we've heard this before, that Biden could kill his political opponents and he'd be in the clear, which means that he could kill Donald Trump and apparently suffer no consequences for it, assuming his party protects him in any impeachment trial. The second one is that he said that Trump could sell secrets, nuclear secrets, to North Korea. And again, it wouldn't be possible to prosecute him for being a traitor unless, again, there was an impeachment. And what we've seen in Congress right now is that Trumpism, MAGA is a cult, and they will protect their own above all else. They don't care about the Constitution. They literally shredded the Constitution in 2020 in their attempt to retain power despite losing the election. The Supreme Court validates that theory that presidents are above the law. I suspect, or I would hope, that it just creates further impetus to completely reform that Supreme Court, that we somehow are able to hold on to the Senate. I think we're going to win the House. If we can hold on to the Senate, we'll have a much stronger majority in favor of eliminating the filibuster. And then we can really seriously talk about reforming the Supreme Court. That means expanding it. It means providing term limits and other similar reforms to essentially fix what is now a broken Supreme Court. There would be no greater loss of credibility for the court than just saying that the president, their president, because it's a 6-3 conservative majority, that their president is above the law. That is unbelievable, unconscionable. And I can't believe that it's even remotely floating the idea in their brains. That's an okay thing to do. That's just how far gone, how partisan, how broken they are.
Ellie Mistel tweeted from the hearing today, Clarence Thomas says presidents in the past have participated in coups, yet there have been no prosecutions. And if he's saying every president coups, why is mine getting charged? So as we look at this, we've also seen a focus on prosecutors going after presidents for political reasons. Roberts, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh have raised those questions. So as if to say, we got to stop this because we don't want prosecutors just going after any old president at any time for anything. And I've said this before, if Ellie also asked this question just minutes ago on his Twitter feed, Ellie Mistel, folks, the question I'd have for the SCOTUS now is, if you do this, why would a Republican president ever peacefully transfer power again, or any president for that matter? And I think that's a valid point. You're right, Marcos. If this goes down, then we're talking about the end of democracy and quite possibly, and as I've said before, in the spirit of truth, reconciliation, and repair, then we should exhume Richard Nixon's body and have a public apology to him, reverse his pardon, and make him president emeritus. And I'll lead that. I'll be the head of that. You know, that's I'll be the head of that effort. So this is really out of his name. You think they would really? Ellie doesn't think they're really going to go through with it, because that's, you're right, man. They're done. The Supreme Court, that's a wrap for the Supreme Court as a credible institution. You think they would really do that?
So there, what the observers are saying is that what seems to be shaking up is the idea of a quote compromise. And the compromise is that the Constitution, I think, is very clear that federal elected officials do have immunity for their official acts. That's not in doubt. It's literally in the Constitution. That means somebody making an argument in Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene defames me in the halls of Congress in a congressional speech. I cannot sue her for defamation because she has immunity in her official acts. She's in Congress, right? So that's not really controversial. The question you hear then is, and this is where the Supreme Court is delaying this until after the election, right? They know what they're doing. The idea isn't to say, yeah, Trump can do whatever, the president can do anything they want. The idea is to say, oh, we don't know if Trump's actions trying to overturn the results of an election is an official act or not. Let's kick it back down to the lower court so they can make that determination. And so what they would do is they would affirm the notion that official, quote, official acts have immunity, but not unofficial acts. So if he robbed the bank while president, that's not an official act. So therefore, he would be liable for that. So what they're going to do here, I think, is I can't imagine they actually say a president can do anything he wants, but they're going to say, oh, we just don't know if the coup attempt was an official act. Wait, let's kick it back to the lower courts so that they can make that obvious determination. It'll take 6 to 12 months for it to work through the lower court, then the appeal court, and then back to the Supreme Court. And by then, the election will either be right around the corner or will already have happened. And then it all depends on whether Trump wins or not. If he wins, obviously, the case is on hold. And I don't know what the statute of limitations is, but it's probably dead for good. Or Trump loses and then it can continue after the fact. But this is clearly an attempt to delay the case until the election. And they're probably hoping Trump wins. So their guy gets off scot-free. There's no reason for it. It's obvious that the coup was not an official act. I don't know why the Supreme Court's going to be plain dumb. It's idiotic.
Yeah, I don't know how they could. I can see them trying to stretch that. He's a president. He wants to make sure. Yeah, I don't know. I just don't see how you do that. And we see the indictments that just came down in Arizona.
Yeah, because there was 60 court cases and they lost all but one of them, right? And the one they won was that Pennsylvania one that was just dealt with 3,000 ballots. So there's just no way you look at this and say it's an official act to stage a coup. The court case is fine. Like, challenge results in court. That's what the court system's there for.
Right.
But they lost those cases, then they launched a coup attempt. So again, it's the court's going to play dumb because they're trying to drag this out to after the election. But I don't think there's any doubt that why they're doing it at this point. And it really does delegitimize them. And Roberts has tried to like save the reputation of the court and his legacy as Chief Justice. Like, he's going to go down as the guy who broke the Supreme Court. And yeah. F that guy.
Yeah, for real. So we'll see how this unfolds. If Trump wins, and I know you and I have not always seen eye to eye on this, and you always talk me down, I'll give you an opportunity to do that again. We are certainly, we have to acknowledge in a 1968 moment, every day another campus is building an encampment, staging a protest, the Ivy Leagues, schools in the South, everybody, the young people, and not just the young people, but I'm talking about students, but the older people like us who support them are speaking out more and more about what's going on in Gaza. Singularly, lately, mobilized and helped by the woeful president of Colombia. When you call police on students and then try to call the National Guard on students, this is what happens. So all the campuses have erupted in solidarity with the students at Colombia around the issue of Gaza. The White House, tone deafly, is trying to impose its will on an HBCU, Morehouse. The Morehouse students and faculty of the Atlanta University Center, Clark, Spelman, Morehouse, have all decried Biden is going to be protested on an HBCU campus. He's in a loose situation. If he withdraws, he's embarrassed. If he goes down there to speak, he's embarrassed. That's his constituency, our constituency, the African-American electorate. Marcos, and I said it on Joy's show the other night, I wonder if he's trying to lose, or is there something that you and the Biden campaign knows that we don't? Now, let me just, before I hand it over to you, let me just throw this out there too. I was speaking with a rabbi this morning, a retired rabbi, but who supports the students and will be joining us with the students on Columbia's campus later. And I said this to her, to the extent that we know, and I've always believed that this is Rovember. It will go down the row. It will go down to women's bodily autonomy. We won every election. It's a choice. Women have a choice. Women are going to make the difference. Well, they don't have a choice, but women will have a choice at the polls between a candidate who says he will, and Biden will codify Roe, versus a candidate who says he will pass a law to permanently ban But we're asking women to make literally a Sophie's choice between their autonomous rights here in this country versus what they're seeing in another country, that being Palestine and Gaza. And it literally is a Sophie's choice. I don't know, man. I got a call just last night from someone we know suggesting that I need to go ahead and have a contingency plan in place to protest Trump's inauguration at the rate things are going. So what are your thoughts? Or am I crazy? You need to talk me down.
Well, Marty, we don't disagree on much, but I think we'll disagree a bit on the Gaza stuff. I think it's an incredibly complicated issue. It's not a simplistic pro-Palestine, pro-Israel question. Both sides are relatively awful in their own ways. Israel is dealing with a government in Gaza that does not recognize its right to exist. That's not the case with all of its other neighbors. Egypt, Jordan just literally helped Israel stop an attack from Iran. Jordanian Air Force literally helped stop it. This is not as simple black and white as people want to make it seem, and don't have a lot of sympathy for people that want to simplify it and make it very binary, because it is an incredibly complex issue. And both sides keep sabotaging peace talks. Neither side's interested. And so when both sides are hell-bent on dragging out the conflict because it thinks it helps them, Hamas thinks that dragging out the conflict and no ceasefire actually helps them politically because it rallies the world against Israel. Israel thinks dragging it out helps them because Bibi wants to stay in power because Bibi's Trump. The second he's out of power, he's in jail, right? These are not great people. Neither side. And obviously, the people that suffer the most are the people of Gaza. And the idea that Gaza, the people of Gaza are suffering just because of Israel is not borne out by the facts on the ground. It's a lot more complicated. And I think most people realize that, which is why it does not have the political salience that a lot of people who watch the protests think they do. Remember, the campuses erupted in protests after the Iraq invasion. George Bush won re-election handily, right? Protests are not a proxy for electoral action. Probably the last time they actually were effective in any real way was the civil rights movement. I can't think of another time where protests pushed for meaningful policy change. Not even the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War ended when Walter Cronkite finally, he spoke up. It wasn't the protesters in a much different world. To me, the question electorally, I still don't see it in the polls. Biden has been moving up in the polls lately. And again, I say don't really pay attention to polls until after the conventions, right? But if you want to pay attention to the polls, Biden is now inching up in a positive direction. And to me, the biggest sort of marker of where the issue stands with young people today is the Harvard Youth Poll. This Harvard Youth Poll is the gold standard. Most polls ask 600 people, 1,000 people. The Harvard Youth Poll is 30,000, 40,000 students at campuses. And in their latest edition, which came out yesterday, Gaza was second to last in the issues of concerns for college students. Number one was reproductive rights. And up there was inflation as well. Inflation, reproductive rights. The lowest issue on their list was student debt, ironically, because they haven't had to pay it off yet, I think. So they don't realize what's coming ahead of them. But second on that list is Gaza. And it clearly resonates with a very loud, very passionate, very engaged segment of students, but it's not overall. It actually ranks very low among students, and which tracks with the fact, and I've talked about this before, I keep looking in the data, trying to find places where it might show up, and I just don't see it. I don't see it having that level of impact on the electorate yet. Ideally, we'd have freaking peace there and it wouldn't be an issue and we wouldn't have strife and we wouldn't have campuses divided and we wouldn't have the mess that is happening and the heartbreak and that so many people are feeling over this and just the horrors, and not to mention the horrors that we're seeing in the Middle East itself. That would be the better situation. But just from a cold electoral calculus, I just don't see it, Mark. It's just not there. It does not resonate as significantly as you would guess from seeing what's happening on the campuses. Just the data doesn't show it.
But that's because what's happening on the campuses has happened in the past 2 weeks. Even at Harvard, there's now an encampment at Harvard in support of the Palestinian cause. USC, Yale, Cal Poly, University of Michigan. I just got a text from Emory today. It is happening everywhere. And that's what I'm saying. It's a moving
It might be. Yeah.
And I'll just be honest with you, this is not you, but I think it's irresponsible of the Biden administration to be dismissive of it because it seems to be escalating and their dismissiveness makes it escalate even more. And you're right, Marcos, it's complex, but the reality is the simple interpretation of what's going on, and that then the simplest interpretation is that there are over 30,000 innocent civilians having been killed in Gaza. That's what everybody's out there for. Nobody's out there advocating for Hamas. All right.
That's not true. There are people that are literally advocating for, but a small percentage, but they are. They are.
You have provocateurs, because I've been there, who infiltrate these issues, but none of these student movements, in terms of their declarations or their oaths or whatever it is they're disseminating, says anything in support of Hamas. And so I know some people want to take it there, but that's a mistake as well, because that further mobilizes people to say, you're not hearing us and you're dismissing what the people are saying. So I think it's perilous, truthfully, for the Biden administration to act as if, and in terms of, I disagree. Lyndon Johnson dropped out of the race because of the Vietnam War. And I think that might have been before Walter Cronkite said what he said. I need to look that up. You're right. Walter Cronkite was the end. But here's the other analogy. What did the Bush administration do during Iraq? They wisely did not allow media to cover bodies coming into Delaware. Mm-hmm. What happened in Vietnam? Every day on television, there were ceremonies, bodies coming in by the droves into Delaware. So what do you have here? You had that in Iran, Iraq war, whatever Bush did, the Iraq war. But you have bodies every day on media, on social media in particular, of Palestinian civilians, which to me has this exact same effect as Vietnam. And I think the lesson in history is in 1968 was Chicago, 2024 is going to be in Chicago. It's going to be huge. I know people are mobilizing. And Republicans, this bears out. Republicans have always gotten away with war. Democrats, they don't do too well in that department and tend to get blamed for those things. I think I think we dismiss it at our own peril.
No, you're right that the trajectory is going could become an issue in the months ahead. Where I'm at right now is that so far it hasn't. And to an electorally significant way, obviously I don't want to dismiss it and saying it's irrelevant because it's relevant to people in the middle of it. But it's when you look at the Harvard poll, it's stuff that people are affected directly. It's one thing to say, I care about what's happening overseas. And I will still say Sudan is a far, millions are dying in Sudan, literally millions are dying in Sudan. And it's not a blip on anybody. Iran, same thing. People dying in Iran, being murdered by the mullahs. It's a blip. So it's harder to get personally riled up. It's one thing to go to a protest. Another thing to really feel it deep in your bones when it's happening somewhere else, but they feel inflation. They feel the assault on their bodily autonomy. So you look at the Harvard list and it's stuff where people are directly impacted by those things. And that's what the election's probably going to revolve around. Now, the Gaza issue, it's inflammatory. It's like it's a cancerous tumor in the body of the Democratic Party of Biden's reelection. It may not kill him today, but it's a problem. It may metastasize, it may spread, it may grow, it may be benign, who knows? But right now, it hasn't in any politically, or not politically, electorally significant way. Whether it evolves into that, I guess we'll see, and we can track that over the coming. And I'm watching closely, Mark. I'm obviously, like, I'm looking at anything that might impact Biden's chances of reelection. And so I'm taking a very close, regular look at the numbers on Gaza, the numbers on the youth vote. And not just that, issues that affect Donald Trump too. The trial, it's actually helping Donald Trump right now, the trials. His numbers are up.
Really?
People act in weird ways. There's a rally around the flag with Republicans around Donald Trump. It's not helping them in the head-to-head against Joe Biden, but it's helping unite the party, people who voted for other candidates in the primary. And a lot of them, I'm sure, even like Nikki Haley voters were like, I won't vote for Trump. I'm like, yeah, you're going to vote for Trump. Most of you are going to vote for Trump. If we can get like 1 in 10 not to vote for Trump, that would be a victory. Most of them will vote for Trump. So we're seeing a rally around the flag effect around Trump because of the trials. Now, again, over time, given how many there are and given that Trump is stuck in courtrooms, that could change, just like the Gaza thing. Right now, it's actually helping Trump and may end up hurting him in the end. Same thing's happening with Gaza, right? There's all these sort of issues that are swirling and they're just metastasizing, right? And where they go from here is a huge unknown. And how they impact the ultimate vote in November, huge unknown, but definitely things that I'm tracking very closely because they matter. They will have an impact one way or the other.
Now that's interesting. You have thousands of protesters around Gaza and upset with Biden. No one is outside the courthouse. And yet you say his numbers are going up. Nobody's coming out there. Yeah. Matter of fact, I'm trying to get in the courthouse, y'all. I think I can get in as media. I'm trying to work that out because some of my MSNBC colleagues got. I'm going to try to go down there one day for our sake, Mark.
That'd be amazing.
Oh my God. Okay, I'm trying to do it because I just want to sleep. And the description of him in the courthouse is that he's sunken and sullen, and also that he's fallen asleep and farting all over the place. That's also, I don't know if that's an exaggeration, but there does seem to be a consensus that he's just a shrunken, shriveled up man in that space. But yeah, that's interesting because I just saw a story the other day. Nobody's come out there to support him. Nobody's come out there to stand with him or anything. So I think that's interesting.
Because in the end, like I've never been a big fan of protest as protest fine as an expression of one's will, but it's as a vehicle for change. A lot of what protests do is it makes people feel better. And that's not how you affect change. Feeling better is not the vehicle. So I know you come from a different tradition than I do, for sure. So again, we may even disagree on that. And how you view a protest may be different than the way I view most people's protests. But I see it as a lot of performative stuff, not you. But even during the Iraq war, which I was all in favor of, obviously, what the protesters were arguing for, but I just did not see them as effective vehicles for actually policy change.
No. I think like everything else, you have to assess it. The Iraq war protests were not effective for whatever reason. Yeah. But we have to acknowledge that historically, some protests have been affected.
Yeah.
Has to do with the time. It has to do with the circumstance. The demonstrations and the protests in Florida in 2000 were affected.
Yeah, but those were sabotage more than they...
They created their end.
Yeah.
What they wanted to accomplish, they were able to accomplish. And again, you know, if we look at Vietnam, those protests affected. There was a symbiotic relationship between the protests and the ongoing sentiment of the nation. And people began, even people who were like, I don't know. Then you got kids out in the street. And obviously they were enough of a threat that those were the protests. And that was the movement that ultimately led to Dr. King's death. I just think not to Biden, someone of his age, not to be able to read the room. Now, I will go out on a limb and say this. The fact that nobody's showing up down there for Trump, it just says to me that hopefully this leads to some level of fatigue because it's just overwhelming. You look at trial after trial, hearing after hearing. One every day, that is one a day. Every day there's a hearing about this dude. We talked about this before. That you as his followers, people as followers go to his cult of personality. And I tell you, when that sheen begins to come off, and it's messy. And then you got a guy, people are human beings, down the witness stand saying he is capturing stories and making up stuff for this candidate against other people. Ben Carson left a sponge in somebody's brain doing brain surgery. That was a headline.
Yeah.
Now, even the most recent person, this is interesting. And wait a minute, we just found out this week, and which is a whole nother rabbit hole we got to go down at some point, that Pecker photoshopped the picture of Lee Harvey Oswald with Ted Cruz's father. Now, here's what's odd, Marcos. If somebody came with a picture and showed us, hey, y'all, I got a picture of Marcos with Lee Harvey Oswald, we're going to say we were never together, but stupid Ted Cruz and his father never even said that. They never said they was never in a picture together, which is also bizarre, which I got to say, why didn't you just say they never met? Instead, you said, my father, to insinuate that my father was in JFK assassination. Hold on, we ain't going there yet. Is this your dad in the picture? He wouldn't answer the question. No, that's another, it's weeks of his own stupidity
When I heard that, I believed it because he didn't deny it. I told everybody, y'all know this is a picture. And everybody believed it until what? What's today? Tuesday. He said, yeah, I fabricated that picture. And we were like, and Ted Cruz, and then asked, listen, here's the other thing. They went to Ted Cruz Tuesday, said, do you have a comment? I don't want to dwell on the past.
What's that about? Packers got stuff on him.
his father had this big YouTube ministry. Shut it down. And so if you're not, that's a whole nother show. I need to call some people who are more into that kind of stuff than me, because you need to explain that to me. How you just succumb to something that is absolutely made up. But I think ultimately it causes people, even people who want to follow things like the Inquirer, it causes people to question, well, how many other things have been said to me that are false? And as we've always said, if it's just that, it's what, 2-3% or less in certain states, that makes a difference.
That's all we need. Mark, it's a 51-49 Democratic-Republican country, people who vote.
Right.
You kick that up by 2 points, 53-46, then you start getting real margins. And it's all it takes. And to me, the sort of the bigger picture in November is the third-party candidates. Keeping an eye on those guys, it could be an issue. They almost never are, but it could be in a very close election. But Trump got 47.3% of the vote in 2020. Is he going to even get that much this time? Has he done anything to grow that electorate? No. And in fact, it shrunk because of COVID deaths. It's his people doing the dying. And it's older Americans, older white people, rural white people that are the core of his base. They're just dying without COVID or no, right? It's just they're old. So for him to get to 47% is going to be a challenge. He's done nothing to expand his electorate. In fact, it's shrunk since 2020. So the question is, can Biden get to 47.1%? He was at 51 and change 2020. If there's even a little bit of bleed, that's okay. Hopefully there isn't. But that's a big question. Is in the key states, is Cornel West going to take enough votes in Detroit, right? Is that a thing that's going to happen and cost Biden Michigan? Is RFK going to have some impact? Right now, the polling, I think, shows that RFK actually takes more from Trump, which makes a lot of sense since he's a conspiracy QAnon type. Yeah. But again, I'm not resting on that yet, because you don't know where things go. You don't know if his conservative vote comes home, like all the sort of conservative RFK supporters, they go back to Trump, and then the ones that are Democrats stay with RFK. That's a possibility, and we can't pretend otherwise. So there's a lot of unknowns here that make it, but it's not a lot, Mark. Like you said, it's just a point here, a point there. I'm not saying it can make a difference. I'm saying it will make a difference. That's where we are right now. So it is a tenuous situation. Obviously, we can't have Trump win. And all of these little factors matter, including the Gaza protests. All of this may have an impact on the margins and could impact the election.
Yeah, just as we're speaking, I'm receiving a video on Instagram. Someone just texted me. Because here's the other problem. So you got Gaza, and you got to watch this, Marcos. It becomes exacerbated when these institutions call the police. And you know, we're going back into George Floyd moment. A half a million views. Atlanta cops tasing a protester on the campus of Emory University. Black male, handcuffed, hands behind his back. He's in handcuffs and they're tasing him. Mm-hmm. So that adds to that. And so I just think we need to be, well, not we, the Biden administration needs to be very careful about this and take it a little more seriously. Moving on, though, before we go, we've not talked about Ukraine. How much of a difference? Because I've been hearing some commentators we know saying that before this money was sent, this aid package went, that Ukraine is losing. We've not talked about that, but I want to get your assessment on it. Is that an accurate statement? Is this going to help? Is it going to make a difference? Where?
Yeah, obviously it's going to make a difference. The question about whether Ukraine is losing is actually, there's two answers. Short term, tactically, like around on the ground, it has lost some ground. Ukraine was running out of ammunition. It was running out of troops. It was running out of equipment. So on the ground, it had some losses at huge cost to the Russians. Tens of thousands of dead Russians to advance 5-10 kilometers. So there's that. More strategically thinking, looking at the big picture, not really. Russia threw everything they could at Ukraine when Ukraine was out of ammunition and literally advanced 5-10 kilometers in locations. And so and meanwhile, Ukraine has developed long range rockets and drones and is striking Russian infrastructure in Russia. So at this point, I'm at a place where we're on the ground. It's impossible for either side. I just don't see how militarily you win on the ground. But what you can do is you can inflict so much economic pain, which is Russia's trying to do that to Ukraine too, right? Taking out Ukrainian infrastructure. But Russia, until this winter, had been spared any real damage on its own soil. And right now, Ukraine is actually hitting oil terminals, natural gas terminals, refining plants, and it's going to inflict more economic pain. And that, to me, is more the situation. So what the aid's going to do, it's going to allow the Russian advances to stop. Again, I don't think they're particularly significant, but they're real. They did move for the first time in 2 years. They moved. That'll allow that to stop because they'll have the ammunition, particularly artillery shells is the one thing that Ukraine is really lacking right now. And once the situation on the ground is static, and I think at this point it'll be static in perpetuity. I don't see a lot of movement either way. They might move 5-10 kilometers one way or the other, tens of thousands of people dying for those inches of ground. It's absolutely brutal and tragic and so fucking ridiculous. I can't believe that Putin's still sticking with this. But then at that point, it becomes a battle of economic attrition. And Russia is under sanction. China is wink helping a little bit, but not fully and openly. And if Ukraine can continue to degrade Russia's industrial and energy infrastructure, there may be a point where Putin says, yeah, this isn't worth it anymore. And that's the biggest, I think, chance for peace. But we're talking 2-3 years down the line at this point. This is going to drag out for a while.
What would happen if Trump were to come in office to help Putin's campaign in Ukraine? Is there something that he would do that would allow Putin to continue the war and ultimately cause Ukraine to absolutely fall?
So what would happen is that the U.S. would seize all aid. That could certainly impact the situation on the ground. Now, Europe is gearing up on a war footing. So Europe is finally, this is one of the tragic or maybe not tragic consequences of the U.S. waffling. It's that Europe has decided that the U.S. is no longer a reliable ally. And thus, they need to take a bigger burden of their defense. And so the U.K. just announced that they're gearing up their infrastructure, their industrial base for wartime production. And you're definitely seeing France step up. France is literally saying that they may actually send troops on the ground. So what this does is literally creates a bigger chance of a wider war if you start seeing the European nations start worrying about Russia advancing too much and they start directly engaging in Ukraine against Russia, that certainly opens up a chance for a wider conflict. And one that could suck the U.S. in, Trump or not, because we do have treaty obligations. And I do wonder how much Trump would say, no, I'm not going to follow. He could. I guess this is Trump we're talking about. He could say, screw NATO, I'm not doing it.
He's pretty much there.
It dramatically increases the chances of a wider war.
Let me plot the same question. How would Netanyahu benefit? What would happen in Israel? What would happen in the Middle East if Trump were reelected?
The aid bill that just passed, that was just signed into law by Biden, has what, $8 billion for Gaza? Humanitarian aid, reconstruction, forget that's out. There's not going to be any more aid for Gaza. Trump is going to be as eliminationist and as genocidal as he's always been, but he's going to give Netanyahu carte blanche to do the sort of things that I think Bibi wishes he could do now, and he can't because he's being restrained by both the international community and by the U.S. actually voting against Israel in the United Nations Security Council, which just happened for the first time a couple of weeks ago. So this idea that Biden is enabling Bibi's actions actually, I think, is contradicted by reality facts on the ground. If anything, Bibi is leashed, I don't know how well, because Bibi's doing whatever the F he wants, but I think things would be a lot worse right now if the U.S. wasn't removing some of that diplomatic cover. Forget that, that'd be all gone. And yeah. I don't know. I can't imagine any possible way that Trump improves the situation or de-escalates the situation, because this is what really needs to be happening. There needs to be a dramatic de-escalation in the region. And it's a minor miracle that it hasn't spread. And I think one of the reasons that it hasn't spread is because, like I said earlier, it's complicated. And Palestinians are seen as tools of Iran, or at least Hamas is. And so Egypt and the rest of the, you know, Arab Peninsula, they don't want to engage in that. They're all fierce rivals. But yeah, with Trump bigfooting in there, acting like he knows what he's talking about. And yeah, I can't even imagine.
And Kushner talking about a reclaimed Gaza is beachfront real estate.
Yeah, screw. Oh my God, they're the worst. They are the freaking worst. Seriously, like I.
Yeah, pretty bad. Pretty bad.
It's really insulting for us as a nation that this is the guy who could be the next president again. Like it does not speak well of us.
Did you all hear what Marcos just said about NATO? They're pretty much working on their own contingency plans. I don't know, when has that happened in the history of NATO? Because NATO comes out of World War II. Mm-hmm. The United States has not had European allies to go out and say, we can't count on you anymore since then. Right? I can't think of any other scenario.
No, and you know what it does too is it sends a signal to Taiwan and South Korea that we can't be trusted, and or therefore they may be more amenable to going along with Chinese aggression or make side deals, because you don't have the U.S. was a bedrock ally for democratic nations in both Europe and Asia. And obviously the U.S. has also gotten bedfellows with Saudi Arabia and despotic regimes. We're not going to pretend that this is all, but broadly speaking, at least in the Pacific and in Europe, it has been a supportive of democracies against autocratic regimes. And now nobody can trust the U.S. anymore. And you can thank Donald Trump for that.
Just one minute. And we were here, we were thinking, we thought the Antichrist was Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. He seems so tame by now.
Reagan. No, but let me tell you what fed it. See, he had six letters in each name. Ronald Wilson Reagan.
Okay.
We had that. It's clear. Then W, maybe he's the Antichrist, right? Or yeah. Dick Cheney, one of them. Because Dick Cheney's running around saying, I am the Antichrist. I'm Darth Vader. Okay, well, get it. Maybe you are. But now you got this, literally, could upend every alliance in the world. His behavior. But I guess it's cumulative. I guess one Antichrist, it's not necessarily going to be one. Scripture might say there'll be several.
Okay.
But just one person, or one period, it just upending the world is just incredible. And it goes to show folks that there is evil in the world. Most of us aren't evil. We don't wake up every morning thinking of evil or planning evil. But there are people who do. And that is why Dr. King would always say to us that we can't afford to be children of darkness, apathetic, but we have to be children of light at all times. So if we see ourselves doing good and we hold ourselves to account for doing good, we have to hold others to that account as well and be ever observant, be ever on watch, because this is a lot of turmoil. And let's face it too, Marcos, and we can talk about this more later. We've talked about it already today, but part of evil is there is an industry that promotes war, that wants war. At the end of the day, you kill a bunch of Palestinian teenagers and their parents, and then the teenagers. You want to create another generation.
No, there's another, yeah.
To keep the wheel spinning. And that, not just there, I'm pointing that out now.
Yeah.
But other places around the world.
Iran wants that because it destabilizes Israel. The Bibi wants that because it keeps them in power. The incentives are all messed up. That's the problem. The incentives say more of war.
Yeah.
That's
evil.
Yeah. Mark, I know we're going to go and I actually got to go too, but there's a guy who took Revelations and he made a really cogent argument about how Donald Trump is the Antichrist based on Revelations. I'm going to send this to you. Maybe we talk about it next week because it's half in jest, but half a ooh. Creepy.
Yeah, send it to me. I can put my exegesis on it, put my theology on it. I'd love to see it. Please do.
The world
is. Send it to me right away. I may be able to, it was good enough. I might use that to preach this weekend.
Will do. Sunday, I'll send it to you right away.
Thursday Coast, folks. The Brief is the podcast. Be sure to download and subscribe. Subscribe also to dailycoast.com if you're not already. And check out some of the polls at civicswithaq.com. Thanks as always, Marcos.
Appreciate you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for getting woke and listening to Make It Plain. As always, perform an act of kindness on behalf of an elder or young person. Write a letter to a sister or brother who just so happens to find her or himself incarcerated. Offer libations to the ancestors upon whose sturdy shoulders we all now stand. And above all, give thanks to the God of your understanding by whatever name you call her and him. All God asks of us is that we give each other love. Thanks for giving MIP love. And please remember to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. If all hearts and minds are clear, it has been made plain.